birds singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird fly, blackbird fly, into the line of a dark black.
Yes, welcome to Animal Voices on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver. In the 8th century, the Greek poet Hesiod wrote, "As long as man continues to be the ruthless destroyer of lower living beings, he will never know health or peace. For as long as men massacre animals, they will kill each other. Indeed, he who sows the seed of murder and pain cannot reap joy and love." How true that is for what was written in the 8th century to this day. Animal Voices coming to you on CFR Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, your community-based and community-sponsored radio station. Our webpage is animalvoices.org, and you can also listen to Animal Voices on the internet through coopradio.org. John Pranger is our technician. Thank you, John, for always being available for us. And he is a longtime supporter of the Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society. In the studio today, we have Marge Adams, a board member of the Vancouver Humane Society. Hello, Marge.
Hi, Carl. I have a little tip for people who have a dog in their family, and this is it. If your dog thinks you are the greatest person in the world, don't ask for a second opinion.
Thank you, Marge. My name is Carl Loskin, and one of my favorite environmental groups is Earth Save Canada. They teach people about the health, environmental, and ethical consequences of our food choices. How important. And they can be reached at earthsave.ca. Earthsave.ca. In our program today, we will be shortly speaking with Rob Laidlaw from ZooCheck, ZooCheck.com. We will ask him about the viability of zoos as educational tools. At the half-hour mark, we will speak with Gwen Barley, who is a policy director with the Wilderness Committee, and we'll be talking about recently published articles and meetings to save our rivers, save the BC rivers from corporate exploitation. Well, I love little quotes, and Gandhi always has some of the best, and he always says, and it's so important for our spiritual and the well-being of the planet, and he said, "I do feel that spiritual progress does demand at some time that we should cease to kill our fellow creatures for the satisfaction of our bodily wants. It ill becomes us to invoke in our daily prayers the blessings of God, the compassionate, if we will not in turn practice elementary compassion towards our fellow creatures, the animals." Well, which turns us to back to much of what is Earth Save's policy here, and why many people choose to stop eating the flesh of animals, and they have a concern about animal rights. Yes, we've dealt with that many times here. And it's said that this is a natural step because of these people's love and respect for animals. Many say we have authority over animals and we can do with them what we wish. But this authority, I believe, is actually meant to be guardianship. As the dominant species on this planet, we have an inherent responsibility to take care of our fellow creatures. Yes, this does not mean that they can be raised inhumanely in cruel conditions for eventual slaughter. These animals are by nature kind and gentle, as we know about the pigs, the cows, the chickens, and they in no way deserve this kind of cruelty that factory farming imposes on these wonderful, gentle and kind creatures that we use for food. Another reason people turn away from meats and dairy is out of our concern for our environment. Our planet is greatly affected by the consumption of these products. And there are many pages will give startling statistics about how the rainforests are being destroyed in the Amazon. 70% of all rainforest is destroyed because of livestock production. And it's staggering the amount of CO2s, harmful CO2s that are produced for the livestock production. Albert Einstein once said that nothing will benefit human health or increase the chances for survival of life on Earth as the evolution to a vegetarian diet. And then, of course, many people will also choose a plant-based diet because of their spiritual and religious beliefs. Well, soon we will have Rob Laidlaw on the line. He's on the line. And one of the reasons we're having him on the line today is because of a gigantic article that it was written in the National Post, and it said, "Put me in the zoo." And Jan Matel, who is a very famous author, of a book called Life of Pi, it's actually a wonderful book. But in this book, he speaks about that the lives of animals in zoos are protected, and they live lives of relative comfort because of the fears that the animals live in the wild. But we're going to hear a contrary view from Rob Laidlaw, who's going to be calling fairly soon, I hope. Anyway.
Yes, Carl, it's my mistake. I didn't notice that he was calling in because I was busy with other things, and so we got picked up on the wrong line. So he's calling back, and it'll be just a few seconds.
Right. Well, okay, that's great.
In fact, there he is.
Okay.
Yeah, hi, Rob. We'll put you on the air right now. Okay, he's on the air.
Well, Rob, welcome to Animal Voices.
Thank you for talking to me today.
Right, and thank you. One of the reasons why, the zoos are, we've just been speaking about this article here, Put Me in the Zoo, it appeared in the National Post this week. And you're a spokesperson for ZooCheck, a wonderful organization that puts many of these zoo articles that we read here into perspective. Maybe you'd just like to give us an overview of your wonderful organization.
Yeah, sure. ZooCheck was started in 1984, and we were mandated originally to deal with roadside zoos, which are the small, sort of more or less amateur zoos that are run by private individuals that are found primarily now in Ontario, but used to be found elsewhere in the country in quite some number. But we also go beyond that, and we deal with challenging outdated zoo concepts and ideas. So that may be the segregation of animals into cell-like environments at night in many of the regular zoos, the keeping of elephants and whales, and those kinds of practices that really don't have a place anymore in at least our vision of modern zoos, and I guess the vision of many people. And we also deal with wildlife issues, so we've been involved in saving elephants in Kenya, providing funds for the research of whales off the Scotian shelf, trying to save wild horses and those types of things. So our mandate deals with quite a broad number of issues, although most of our core work deals with animals in captivity.
And thank you for having also been a sponsor of the Animal Voices Film Festival. We really appreciate your support. But now, zoos often judge their standards by what other zoos are like and what the zoo's standards has been in the past. But what do you say about that?
Well, most of the zoo standards aren't worth the paper they're written on. They tend to gravitate towards the lowest common denominator. So if you've got a group of zoos that form an association, they obviously don't want to create a standard that will exclude their own members from being accredited or approved by the association that they've formed. So what you find is that most of the zoo standards are very minimal, and they address some of the needs of animals, but usually they fall far short of addressing the critical needs of animals. And when I say critical, I mean not only the needs of them to eat nutritive food or have water available or to be sheltered from snow or wind or rain, but also to have a proper lifestyle, you know, to be able to engage in the things that they normally would engage in if they were in the wild. So, you know, rather than being left in a cage all day with nothing to do, standards should address the fact that animals need things to do, need to live natural lives, need lots of complex space, but unfortunately they don't. So my view of standards is that they're probably better than nothing, but probably not very much better than nothing.
Now, maybe you can give us a rundown of what kind of animals there are. I believe there's giraffes in Calgary, and of course we've had a deplorable situation with hippos here in Vancouver. I mean, just maybe how pervasive is this in Canada?
Well, certainly there's zoos in every province except Prince Edward Island. They don't have any zoos. And there's a continuum. There are zoos that are very, very poor, and there are zoos that are better than poor. But I don't think we have any zoos in this country that are sort of the cream of the crop that you could point to saying that's how a zoo should operate. And in fact, in visiting zoos all over the world and in looking at this issue for over the last 20 years, I've probably only seen about 10 or 12 zoos that I think really operate the way that most people think zoos should or do. And like I said, Canada doesn't have any of those zoos and has a very long way to go in improving.
Is there, Rob, this is Marge Adams, is there room in today's world for zoos at all? Is there any need for them? Is there any justification for them?
Well, it's really funny because when I first started all this, seems like 100 years ago, but I was an avid zoo supporter, and I came across a roadside zoo in Ontario in 1984 and thought, my God, why does this thing exist? Surely it's an anomaly, and found out very quickly that there were many roadside zoos. So I sort of morphed my attitude into that from being a zoo supporter to being a supporter of professional zoos. But as I've learned more and more and more about the zoo industry, I've come to believe that zoos are an unnecessary evil. Many people who don't like zoos think they're a necessary evil and buy into the education and conservation argument, which really doesn't hold water. I used to be one of those people, but now I'm to the point where I think zoos are an unnecessary evil. They are net consumers of wildlife. I think they miseducate people. They do nothing for conservation, and they're basically there for entertainment. So I don't think that there's a role for zoos as most people see them today, although I do think there is a role for specialist facilities like the Elephant Sanctuary and places like that that retire animals, and for the specialist conservation facilities that actually do breed animals for reintroduction programs and are scientifically based and they're not open to the public and all that. So I think there's a place for zoo-like facilities, but not for menagerie-style public zoos like most people are familiar with.
I should think often zoos are operated for the money that they bring in. But these private zoos, for example, they're certainly paying somebody money, aren't they? And that would be the
well, certainly
initial.
They're the most crassly commercial facilities,
yeah.
You know, the SeaWorlds and the African Lion Safaris. But I think most zoos, even the publicly run zoos, they're part of an industry, and that industry generates income for all of the people that are involved in that industry. Many of the facilities are seen as tourist attractions. I think that to a very large extent, the entire industry revolves around money, and it's not just the sort of crassly commercial facilities that advertise their leaping whales or camel rides or things like that.
Right, yeah.
Now you mentioned education as a system of justifying zoos, but also, you know, these animals in zoos have a limited lifetime, so they there's much... information in the mainstream media saying that that's the way to educate children especially, but also that many of these, they're bred in captive conditions. But in fact, when they're bred in captivity, are they not basically being used to maintain their specimens on show as opposed to letting them in the wild? What's the position there?
Yeah, most of the zoo breeding programs, including the very high-profile North American Species Survival Plans, were never constructed for putting animals back into the wild. And people think that they were. They think that zoos created these programs because there was this conservation need and that they were going to take the surplus and put all these animals back into the wild. But that's not why they were created. They were actually created to ensure that certain types of animals were available for zoo displays back in the 1970s when international treaties came into place that hindered the ability of zoos to acquire animals from the wild. And there was also a few other pieces of legislation primarily in the United States, like the Animal Welfare Act, that placed additional restraints on the traditional operation of zoos. So these breeding programs started as a way for zoos to secure animals for their own displays, and only later were they changed into quote-unquote conservation programs. But the whole idea of breeding as a conservation strategy is absurd, because what happens when you breed animals in captivity is that natural selection is removed. You're arbitrarily deciding which animals breed with which animals, and you breed, whether it's conscious or not, traits that make animals suitable for captivity and that may hinder their survival in the wild. And there's a whole ream of academic literature on this field showing that changes, profound changes in animals, can occur in a first-generation captive born. So this whole idea of captive breeding is ridiculous on a scientific level, and except in the most exceptional circumstances as a last-ditch attempt to prevent an extinction of an animal. But it's also a fallacy that people believe that zoos have promulgated. They just don't do what they say they're doing. If you added up all the animals that were released from zoos, compared to the numbers of animals that are in these zoos, it's negligible in the extreme. So they don't do very much in that regard at all.
Now, according to your webpage, zoocheck.com, nothing could be truer than just what you said, that the traits are altered when these animals are bred in captivity. But it's true of steelhead trout. That really surprised me. I loved your webpage.
Oh, thank you. What we try to do is put information on our website that's relevant to the issues that we're working on, obviously, but also things that have some scientific basis and that are new and useful for people that are really considering the types of issues that we're discussing right now. So I'm glad you found that useful. But I always have to stress to people that this whole idea of captive breeding, it's very arbitrary, it's artificial, and it doesn't work.
I'll quote you two sentences from your webpage. It said, steelhead trout reared in hatcheries were much less good at reproducing than wild fish. And that the other sentence that caught my eye was, for fish to so quickly lose their ability to reproduce is stunning.
Oh, it is. It is. Because people used to think that genetic changes and behavioral changes would take many generations you know, to be bred out of captive animals. And it's only in the last 5 to 10 years that a lot of this research has come forward showing that, no, that's not true, that changes can be, at least in an evolutionary sense, almost instantaneous, and that just because you've bred an animal from parents that were caught in the wild doesn't mean that that animal that's been produced isn't different from its parents, because it just may be. And, you know, obviously, with each successive generation in captivity, the changes become more and more and more profound, so that you have an animal that, while it may on the surface look like its counterpart in the wild, may be profoundly different in many, many ways.
Now, aquariums are these zoos, or how do you categorize that?
Aquariums are definitely zoos, and so are sea parks. They're just aquatic zoos. And, unfortunately, many people who visit aquariums, particularly with those with mostly with fish and invertebrates, you know, they don't or may not have the same kind of negative feeling as they may when they see a lion or a tiger or some other animal. But all of the creatures that are in aquariums are facing similar kinds of problems that their terrestrial counterparts are. And a lot of people don't realize that aquariums go out and capture animals on a regular basis, even more so than terrestrial zoos ever do.
So that, of course, is dolphins and whales. I mean, this is are you people involved in dealing with the aquarium zoos? Maybe that's what they should be called, aquarium zoos. But how has that been going?
It's up and down. We have two facilities in the country currently that house cetaceans, meaning the whales and dolphins, and that's the Vancouver Aquarium and Marineland in Niagara Falls, Ontario. And it's a very, very difficult issue to deal with. Ultimately, what should be done is a federal prohibition on the importation of animals, the whales and dolphins, from other countries, and a prohibition on the capture of animals from our own waters around Canada, particularly in the Arctic. But getting things done on a federal level, getting new laws in, when our lobby, meaning all the animal groups, is very, very small and the country so spread out, it's an enormous challenge. So, you know, there have been some inroads that have been made, and we've certainly campaigned to stop places like the Granby Zoo from acquiring dolphins, and we did that successfully, and, you know, put a lot of pressure on places like the West Edmonton Mall. But dealing with these last two holdouts, the Vancouver Aquarium and Marineland, that's a tremendous challenge. So I don't know what's going to be happening with that in the future, but we're certainly not going to give up, but it is challenging.
I would think that legislation is probably the best answer, isn't it, Rob, if you could be successful enough in getting it through. I have a question about that. I know with the Vancouver Humane Society, we try to encourage the exotic legislation in this province, and it usually comes down to local governments, like not importing animals for sale. And I'm wondering, have you had any success on the provincial or the federal level in getting legislation, suitable legislation?
If you mean just generally for wildlife in captivity, yes, we have. We've certainly been able to affect policy in the maritime provinces. We've managed to, despite the enormous obstacles here in Ontario, we've managed to force the Ministry of Natural Resources to take action on a number of zoo situations. We've had very good success in Alberta. It took us 10 years, but we finally facilitated them passing zoo regulations in April of 2006, and now the battle is enforcement, because most of these campaigns are two-step campaigns, getting the laws in place and then convincing the authorities that are in charge of those laws to actually enforce them. So I would say that there's still a ways to go, but certainly progress has been made.
It's much more effective if you can get it at the provincial or the federal. Now, what about your response from federal government, or have you gone that route yet?
Well, animals in zoos, that's a provincial responsibility.
Okay.
That has been delegated to them by the federal government. But if you're talking about things like migratory birds and marine mammals, then there are mechanisms at the federal level that can deal with these problems. But it's like I said, most of the groups here don't have the ability, either individually or collectively, to create enough pressure pressure to force the government to do something on the federal level. Our lobby is just too small. So we have to grow that lobby and increase its influence to try to get some of these laws in place.
Mm-hmm. Now, in closing, Rob Laidlaw from ZooCheck.com, it's been said that man is the only animal that lives in captivity outside of a cage. Now, which, of course, leads me to this, I'm sure you saw the National Post with a full-page full-page story about Jan Matel's book, which was The Life of Pi, and, of course, about a tiger and the experience. Did you read that book?
I tried to read it, and I actually, I'm not a big fiction reader. I'm a non-fiction reader, and I actually didn't get through the book.
Well, anyway, they published a counter to the article, and I'll read it a bit after the interview. But in closing here, just one other question here. We only have about a minute left. Today's children have access to what's called an absolute gluttony of images of wildlife beyond anything experienced by any generation in human history. Why do we need zoos?
Well, exactly, and also I would add to that that not only is all this imagery available through many different kinds of media, I think if you want to learn about nature and commune with nature and establish that connection, just get outside. Get outside in your backyard. There's wonderful nature in your backyard, in local parks and national parks. It's all around us, and people have to recognize that they don't need to go to a zoo to see wonderful wildlife. It's everywhere you look.
Thank you, Rob Laidlaw. You're a wonderful spokesperson for ZooCheck.com.
Thank you for having me.
I recommend everybody have a look at that wonderful webpage.
Thank you. And
support them. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you very much.
Bye, Rob.
Bye.
Well, yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver. And do we have our next... our webpage is animalvoices.org. Many of our programs are placed on the internet. John, thank you for always doing that. People want to listen to some of the programs. We have some 20 or 30 different programs there. You can see what you're listening to. And there's a little caption there that says what you're going to be listening to. So well, we have another caller on the line. It's Gwen Barley, and she's a director with the Wilderness Committee. And we're going to be discussing saving BC rivers from corporate exploitation. Welcome to Animal Voices, Gwen Barley.
Hello.
Yeah. Well, what a wonderful meeting that was this past week at the Britannia Center. It was standing room only, and obviously people are really interested in saving our rivers. But maybe you can explain to us, saving our rivers from what?
Well, I will explain that. And it's saving our rivers from the privatization that comes along with private power projects. And I'll just give a little bit of history. That in 2002, the BC government introduced a new energy plan, which forbade BC Hydro, which is our crown corporation, from producing new hydroelectricity power, and all new power was going to go to the private sector. So what happened was there was a mad gold rush to stake claims on pristine rivers and creeks and streams across British Columbia, and today we have over 536 water bodies that are staked by private companies to develop private power projects. And it's not oftentimes when people think of, they're euphemistically called run of river, oftentimes people think, oh, you just have a little turbine in a river. But that's not the case, that you have large projects and up to 92-95% of the river is being diverted into a tunnel called a penstock, and that goes on for usually several kilometers.
Now there's some, the Common Ground magazine listed a map showing some 532 rivers.
Yes.
And what's actually, who's claiming on this and who's going to be benefiting and what's happening there?
Well, who's going to be benefiting are the private corporations and the private companies that have staked the claims on the rivers and are going to be developing private power projects, that they enter into very lucrative contracts with BC Hydro, who pays these private contractors at rates that are sometimes double current electricity rates, and the projects can be worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And BC Hydro right now has energy purchase agreements over the next 20 and 30 years that are worth $28 billion that that are with these private power projects.
So that's why they say these rivers are being stolen from the people of British Columbia. It's stolen. Maybe you could go into that a bit.
Yeah, well, it's definitely, I mean, some people would say stolen and other people would say given away. But as an environmental organization, we're very, very concerned about, because the government isn't looking at the cumulative impact of these projects. And with these private power projects that you have dams, you have a tremendous amount of water diversion. The river gets diverted, as I mentioned earlier, into these long tunnels that go on for kilometers. And you also have logging, you have road building, you have transmission lines that can go on for tens or if not hundreds of kilometers. And you multiply that by over 500 times, and you have a significant problem. And there's a right way to do green power in British Columbia, and there's a wrong way. And unfortunately, in British Columbia, we're doing it the wrong way.
This legislation that was to permit this, the rivers to be used for corporations.
Yes.
Maybe you can mention which corporations are involved. And when this legislation came through, I believe it's already gone through. Was it done behind closed doors? Because we didn't hear much debate, or did I miss it?
Well, no, there's been very, very, very little a public debate. And that's one of the problems when you have projects of this magnitude that encompass virtually the entire province, that you want to have public participation and public discourse about what's happening with the future of our rivers. And that hasn't happened, as though it's beginning to happen right now. And the companies that are involved range from a very, very large company called Plutonic. Ledcor is a giant construction company that has projects on the Ashley River. You also have a company that's called Run of River that's involved in several projects in the Pitt River. But what I would recommend is that people go to a website called ippwatch.info, and you can find out not only which companies are involved in staking which rivers, but all sorts of background information, where the rivers are located, how big the projects will be, and it's just and plus you'll be able to see the map, which plots all of the projects, and it's just really a slap in the face, and it's a huge eye opener.
So this Pitt River, is that in Pitt? That's part of the Pitt Meadows here, just outside of Vancouver?
It is. It's about 25 kilometers outside of Vancouver, and it's a very, very important salmon tributary into the Fraser River. And normally, private power projects, that the projects are situated above, there's usually a break or a waterfall, or sometimes the projects are situated above where salmon or fish go. But that's not always the case, and of course, the other thing that can happen is what happened in Miller Creek, which is an independent power project that's up in the Sea to Sky Corridor near Pemberton. And the projects, once they're up and running, provide very, very few jobs because they're heavily automated. And so on September 8th of this year, there was a malfunction at the Miller Creek private power project, and the creek was nearly dewatered for several hours. And that had an impact on salmon many kilometers downstream, whitefish, bull trout, which are endangered species. And there were alarms that went off at the Miller Creek when there was this malfunction and water stopped flowing into the creek. But the alarms were sent to Edmonton, and nobody in the Edmonton office, and we still aren't sure why, recognized that there was a problem in the Miller Creek project. And so this situation where there wasn't water flowing into the creek went on for several hours. And so there's a huge concern that these projects not only, impacting endangered species, but have the ability to impact fish many kilometers downstream, as well as just, you know, the large ecological impact they can have from transmission lines, logging, and roads from a variety of these projects.
Now, did you go and visit one of these areas and you had great difficulty in getting through there? Maybe you can just give us some idea of the bureaucracy and... Over to you. Go.
Well, what we did earlier this year, and I think it was in March or April of this year, I'd never seen a private power project. And so I went up to the Ashley River, which is located near Squamish, and this is the project that's operated by Ledcor, which is a large construction company. And when we went up there, it's on a public road, and we went up and just to take a look at the project, and we were immediately stopped by Ledcor's people, and they said, "We want to see your ID." And again, even though we were on public property, it was crown land and it was a public road. And then they said I was out taking pictures of the project, and I wasn't taking pictures of people, and they came up to me and said, "You can't take pictures." And then another time when we went up, they blocked our access with a vehicle that we've been, in my experience, when I've been up there, we've been followed by Ledcor people wherever we go in the Ashloo area that were... just followed in wherever, whichever direction we go, and we knew this because some people had scanners, and so they could pick up what they were saying on their walkie-talkies.
So you're certainly not welcome to go and see what is being done on Crown land, is it?
No. No, you aren't welcome, and if anything, you're strongly discouraged. And it just really sort of gives you the idea that 5 years ago, the Ashloo was a wild river. And now, when we went out there, it's a large construction zone.
Now, what is the impact of NAFTA? Marge, do you have a question?
Yes, I do. I get so irritated when I hear what's going on in this province. It's my home province for my lifetime, practically. And what is the justification that the provincial government gives for giving away our rivers? Are they getting a huge amount of money to subsidize the tax base or something? Is there any justification to do this?
I think that's one of the really surprising things, is that when you start looking at these projects and you start scratching beneath the surface, you realize there's very little justification. That BC Hydro, which used to produce our hydro for British Columbia, with a crown corporation, it had accountability, it had oversight, and there were problems with the large dams, but at least you had the public accountability that came across with the large crown corporation. And not only that BC Hydro returned about $700 to $800 million yearly in dividends from hydro projects that went back to the people of British Columbia to build hospitals, to build schools, to build libraries. Mm-hmm. And this new push towards private power, it doesn't make sense from an ecological perspective, and it definitely doesn't make sense from an economic perspective.
And we had one of the lowest hydro
rates. We did. We had one of the third lowest rates in North America. And the other two low rates are also Quebec and Manitoba, both of which are publicly owned utilities.
Yeah.
So now we're buying our hydro from, or increasing larger portions of our hydro from these private corporations at oftentimes double the market rate. And as I mentioned earlier, BC Hydro is now on the hook through energy purchase agreements to these private corporations for $28
billion.
And that money goes back to corporate shareholders. It doesn't go back to the people of this province.
Now, not only is it involving the public land here, but it also involves the indigenous peoples.
It does.
Maybe you can say something about that.
Well, you're absolutely right that there it's much crown land in British Columbia is First Nations indigenous lands, traditional lands. And so you have these projects that are going ahead that aren't taking into account title and rights, that sometimes they're negotiating deals with certain First Nations, but it's something that is an infringement on title and rights, and there isn't full public accountability and negotiations and open negotiations with First Nations. So there's a lot of concerns, not only for the public of British Columbia, but also for First Nations.
Following on Marge's question there, mm-hmm. and the money aspect, mm-hmm. follow the money, they always say.
Yeah.
What is the involvement with these long-term contracts? How long are they? And what is NAFTA part of this whole scheme?
Well, there are long-term contracts, and most of the energy purchase agreements with private producers run anywhere from 20 to 40 years. But after those contracts run out, the private energy producers can sell their energy anywhere. It can go towards heating swimming pools in California in 40 years. And that will have to pay whatever the market will bear when these energy purchase agreements run out with BC Hydro. So this new energy plan is not providing for energy security for British Columbians in the long term. And then the other thing that you were mentioning, of course, was what impact does NAFTA and other international trade agreements have when we privatize a Crown corporation that had a monopoly on the production of, or a near monopoly on the production of hydro in British Columbia. And I'm not an expert in NAFTA, but from talking with other people who are, that we're losing the ability to plan coherently for energy security in the province, and we're giving NAFTA more power through the privatization of our hydro in British Columbia.
Now, it's not only hydro, but it's also water supply. Is that correct? Because you're building a dam, or how does this work?
Well, they're run of rivers. As I mentioned, they're euphemistically called run of river, which means that they don't have large storage capacity like the big dams that you have traditionally in British Columbia under BC Hydro. And so that's one of the concerns, is that the energy that is being supplied by these private power projects is something called soft energy. It's intermittent, and because they can't store it, it's often produced during the spring freshet, and that's when you get a large spring runoff. So it's at a time when it's not most efficiently used in the province. So there is there's lots of talk about trying to firm up that energy, and how you firm up that energy and make it more valuable to private producers is either you get access to the dams in British Columbia through BC Hydro, which are like large batteries, or you start developing storage capabilities with these private power projects. And then, of course, they move from being somewhat smaller projects into being much larger projects, but it's just a multitude of problems wherever you look with the private power projects, ranging from, you know, ecological problems to economic problems.
Now, I was just wondering if you could just summarize this whole project with the rivers in British Columbia.
Yes.
And I really appreciate your wonderful input.
No problem. And so did you want to have...
Maybe you can just summarize, give us an overall picture of many of the things you've said now, and
sure.
Really appreciate that.
Sure. Well, again, what you have is, in 2002, the BC government arbitrarily forbade BC Hydro, a Crown corporation that was very profitable, from producing new hydroelectricity. And they said that all new hydroelectricity production would come from the private sector. So we had an absolute gold rush across the province with private companies and corporations running out to stake our rivers and streams in all areas of the province. And today you have over 536 water licenses that are targeted towards the production of private hydroelectricity. And you have a large cumulative impact that comes along with that, that there's roads, there's logging, there's kilometer after kilometer of transmission lines, there's... large portions of the river, up to 95%, are being diverted into penstocks, which are large tunnels, before the water is returned. And then the other thing is you have very, very, very little transparency or oversight. And the government, in response to the independent power project that went into the Ashlew, there's a big community hue and cry about that. And so the government didn't like that, because it looked like that project wasn't going to go ahead. And they introduced a bill called Bill 30. And Bill 30 stopped local municipalities from having zoning authority over independent power projects. And so that prevented one of the most accountable levels of government from being able to say yes or no to whether private power projects went into their neck of the wood. So it's become very undemocratic. It's something that's hugely profitable to a handful of very powerful companies. And it's a bad approach and a bad way to produce green power from an environmental perspective, because of the cumulative impacts and the lack of accountability and transparency. And it's a terrible way the impact, the economic impact on taxpayers and the citizens of British Columbia, just due to the fact that BC Hydro is on the hook for $28 billion in future energy purchase agreements.
Thank you for saying it so nicely about what is our heritage, our rivers, British Columbia. Now, if somebody, I can see Marge is wanting to write to her MP right away.
And it's a provincial matter, so you wouldn't be writing to your MP, which is a member of parliament. You'd be contacting your MLA, which is a member of the Legislative Assembly.
Good.
And let them know how you feel about that, and that you want questions answered, and that there needs to be democratic oversight, and there needs to be accountability, because that is completely missing right now.
What's your preferred website?
Well, there's some very good websites that people can go to. You can go to HydroFacts, which is HydroFacts, and I believe it's .ca. And another excellent website to go to is, as I mentioned earlier in the show, is ippwatch.info. And that gives you a detailed overview of the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of projects that are potentially coming online in British Columbia. It gives you a map of British Columbia so you can see where they're happening in your neighborhood, your neck of the woods. It tells you the companies that own the projects, how many megawatts of power they can produce, and also revenue streams. And it's incredibly informative, and the map is just a slap in the face.
Gwen, I have one other question.
Yes.
Now, the Hydro has agreed to $28 billion in contracts. Now, do the public have any protection at all from these rates that they will have to pay? Or is that controlled by the contract with BC Hydro that they...
Well, you're going to see an increase in hydro rates that and this gets into a sort of a level of complexity, that with the dams that produce hydro under BC Hydro, the government put into place something called a heritage contract, and that will keep prices frozen at a certain level. And it's important because, of course, obviously you don't want families gouged in electricity, but also it's important to remember that about 60% or 70% of the electricity that is used in British Columbia is not through individuals, it's through corporations and businesses. So that heritage contract also keeps their rates frozen at a very, very, very low rate. However, new energy that has been purchased from the private power projects, the private hydropower projects, is going to come in at a much, much, much higher rate. And eventually more and more of our energy purchases will come from private hydro. And so and you're going to see a steep increase in prices. And in some cases, you actually want to see electricity rates reflect the real cost of electricity, but you don't want to be punitive to families that need to heat their homes. And one of the, of course, the problems with the private power agreements is that they're getting contracts that are sometimes double what the electricity prices are forecast to be in the near future. So it's sort of a bizarre circumstance where you have a handful of companies that are profitingly handsomely from these very, very lucrative contracts with BC Hydro.
John, did you have a question?
Well, it sounds like a very dark mixture, but isn't the justification ultimately that a government is incompetent and can't do a job as well as private interests, and therefore we're justified in doing this because it'll lower the price of things?
Well, yes. I mean, I think the only rationale you can see for heading in this direction is ideology based on the private sector doing it better. But as I mentioned earlier, the lowest electricity prices in North America are provided by public utilities in British Columbia, Manitoba, and Quebec. And it shows that there is a great efficiency in these crown corporations that don't have a huge profit, imperative. And that they've done a great job in producing cost-effective hydroelectricity to people and also having public oversight. But if you do buy into the mythology and the ideology that there is inherent efficiencies in the private sector and they can do it better, that's why we're having this onslaught of private energy that's actually very inefficient, has a large ecological impact, and has very, very little public oversight. But that is the rationale for why we're heading in the direction we're heading in British Columbia.
And this has come out of the think tanks that want to see things that way, right?
Yes, it's there's very little benefit to the people of the province, and there's a lot of benefit to a handful of large corporations.
Thank you, Gwen Barley, for you're a policy director with the Wilderness Committee. You do so many different things, saving the forests, and a wonderful organization. And now you're involved with saving the rivers of BC from corporate exploitation. Thank you for what you do, and thank you for being on Animal Voices.
Thank you for having me, and enjoy your weekend.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. And yes, of course, it is Thanksgiving south. It's Thanksgiving south of the border, and today is Black Friday. I'm not sure why they call it Black Friday, but it's one of the days. Like the Thursday was the Thanksgiving, and it's when the frenzy of purchasing for Christmas starts, and so it gives an indication. But to be kind to the people south of the border, we have about 7 minutes left. Some kind person sent me a article about some years ago, Dick Cheney was involved with he went. Hunting birds, and of course he accidentally shot one of his colleagues who was a high-ranking person, a beneficiary of the Republican institution government. But anyway, this article said that while most people are lamenting the violence in Pakistan, Burma, Afghanistan, and Iraq, apparently it's not enough bloodshedding for Vice President Dick Cheney. Last month, in a caravan of 15 sport utility vehicles and an ambulance, no jokes please, Cheney made his way to Clove Valley Rod and Gun Club, about 70 miles north of New York City, for a day of controlled bloodletting. Cheney landed at Stewart Air Force Base and took off the following day for the upscale gun club at a cost of $32,000 for local law enforcement officials who guarded his hotel, protected his motorcade, and diverted school buses. Unlike Cheney's 2000 trip to Rolling Rock Club in Pennsylvania, in which he killed 70 pheasants and an undisclosed number of ducks, his hunting party killed 417 pheasants. This time it was remained tight-lipped about the take. An employee who answered the phone would not disclose which species were shot, and pheasants, ducks, and Hungarian partridges. But apparently it costs $150,000 a year to join this exclusive club where you can do some bloodletting. So that's Dick Cheney and his sadistic passion for shooting tame animals. Careful. Over to you, Marge.
Oh, thank you. Now, I just have a very few minutes left, but I have a lovely little dog story, one of my favorites, so I'll try to fit it in. It's called A Friend in Need. Brownie and Spotty were neighbor dogs who met every day to play together. Like pairs of dogs you can find in most any neighborhood, these two loved each other and played together so often that they had worn a path through the grass of the field between their respective houses. One evening, Brownie's family noticed that Brownie hadn't returned home. They went looking for him with no success. Brownie didn't show up the next day, and despite their efforts to find him, by the next week he was still missing. Curiously, Spotty showed up at Brownie's house alone, barking, whining, and generally pestering Brownie's human family. Busy with their own lives, they just ignored the nervous little neighbor dog. Finally, one morning, Spotty refused to take no for an answer. Ted, Brownie's owner, was steadily harassed by the furious, adamant little dog. Spotty followed Ted about, barking incessantly, then darted towards a nearby empty lot and back, as if to say, "Follow me, it's urgent." Eventually, Ted followed the frantic Spotty across the empty lots as Spotty paused to race back and bark encouragingly. The little dog led the man under a fence, past clumps of trees, to a desolate spot half a mile from the house. There Ted found his beloved Brownie alive, one of his hind legs crushed in a steel leg-hole trap. Horrified, Ted now wished he hadn't taken Spotty's earlier appeal seriously. Then Ted noticed something quite remarkable. Spotty had done more than simply lead Brownie's humans to his trapped friend. In a circle around the injured dog, Ted found an array of dog food and table scraps, which were later identified as the remains of every meal Spotty had been fed that week. Spotty had been visiting Brownie regularly in a single-minded quest to keep his friend alive by sacrificing his own comfort. Spotty had evidently stayed with Brownie to protect him from predators, snuggling with him at night to keep him warm and nuzzling him to keep his spirits up. Brownie's leg was treated by a veterinarian, and he recovered. For many years thereafter, the two families watched the faithful friends frolicking and chasing each other down the well-worn path towards their houses. Isn't that a wonderful behavior? Such a wonderful dog.
Such companions.
Yes.
Well, we only have about 2 minutes left and no time for any music, but there's been two major articles, always two, 3 pages in the fashion promoting fur. And we're going to read one of the letters from Clara Cooney, which appeared in, I believe, Wednesday's Vancouver Sun, or Thursday's. And it was basically, the article in the Vancouver Sun said, "Looks like luxury," in the arts and life section. Anyway, this was a brief letter from Clara Cooney, and said, "It was disappointing to read another newspaper article lauding the use of animal fur in the fashion industry. The people who object to this are not kooks or eccentrics, but rather conscientious individuals who are aware of the horrendous treatment these animals undergo for no better reason than to accessorize luxury garments. Most of us know that the animals are slaughtered in a barbaric, painful manner, having lived a miserable life, stressed out life on these farms." Anyway, thank you, Clara Cooney, for writing to the Vancouver Sun and having it published. I will close off with our initial quote from the 8th century, and the Greek poet Hesiod wrote, "As long as man continues to be the ruthless destroyer of lower living beings, he will never know health or peace." You've been listening to Animal Voices. Thank you for listening.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird fly, blackbird fly, into the line of a dark black night.